This is Monocle on Design, the weekly show on the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. This week...
Sounds very simple, but what we're doing then is managing energy, lighting, heat, to respond to your needs when you need it.
We ask how the Internet of Things is changing product design and transforming how we think about everything from our homes to our cities. Plus,
it became clear to people that certain types of data were being collected by the building to make it more productive and energy efficient. When people see the benefits of it, then there are very few people who don't want to sign up.
A word with the architect behind an Amsterdam office building dubbed the smartest in class, and a natter about how technology is helping us live better in ever more crowded cities. That's coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Bennett. Do stay tuned. Now, over the past few months, Monocle has teamed up with US-based bathroom and kitchen firm Kohler to host a series of talks entitled All Things Connected. The global cavalcade of conversations dropped anchor in Singapore, London, Toronto, Dubai and Bangkok variously to gather opinions on the future of everything from the kitchen to the sustainable cladding of buildings. And crucially, how these different disciplines are harnessing the opportunities of better connectivity to create improved experiences, reduce waste and even engineer a little more wonder into our everyday interactions. Mark Bickerstaff is my first guest. He's the Director of New Product Development at Kohler Kitchen and Bath and something of a sage on the matter. His current focus is increasing connectivity in the bathroom through technology, artificial intelligence and a little more human-centred design. I started by asking Mark how he and his team at Kohler define what's meant by the somewhat kicked-about term smart when it comes to design.
I think smart has a very simple definition for us, which is it has to make it better. And better in the context of the use of the environment and society and culture. So smart to us is the application of technology. It's not the technology itself. And I think that's something we have to keep reminding ourselves about, that really the reality of this is enabling better things. We've created products, for instance, in bathrooms where they are responding to your entry and exit. It sounds very simple, but what we're doing then is managing energy, lighting, heat, to respond to your needs when you need it and customize to what you prefer. And I think that is a tangible benefit, both for you, because it's a better experience, but it also saves energy and resources in the long term and in the overall picture. So that's tangible. And then, you know, the reality of water usage, you know, I saw a fascinating documentary about this the other day, which talks about all sorts of things, but clean water is a very valuable resource, and so we have a role there in reducing the consumption of it. And we can do that by optimizing its use for your function. You know, we're very used to just, you know, opening the tap and seeing the water flow down the drain and not worrying about it. In some parts of the world, that will matter, and we've introduced smart technology that customizes the water flow to what you're trying to do. You need a different water flow to wash your toothbrush, to what you need for when you're shaving, or and so on. So these are really tangible areas where we're working on how products really can improve the way we use resources through smart technology.
And you use the word need. I think that's an interesting kind of avenue for exploration. You know, people's needs are changing. I think in the kind of global context, we're more urban than we've ever been before. We live in slightly smaller areas, certainly a higher density city. How are people's needs changing? And, you know, is the bathroom, it's something I've heard people discuss, is it becoming more of a nexus for life? Is it becoming a place of well-being, of reflection, literally and figuratively, and also a kind of a place where you get a little privacy in a world that's increasingly less private?
All of those things. Very much multi-mode, you know, and urban densification is a real challenge. We see it working two ways. We see it making small spaces ever more important to get right. We're still learning how to do that. You know, there's been a lot of experimentation for a long time in places like Japan, where the Asian cities really are, you know, leading examples of this. So having a gracious experience in a small space really is a challenge. You know, it's not something that we like particularly. We are not hive animals. You know, we tend to want open spaces. So there's a challenge there, and innovation and smart technology can help us create great experience there. On the other side, luxury, absolutely, is viewed as escape. And a bathroom is a place of escape where we can connect with the sort of vital element of water, but also find those tangible and real moments of relaxation transformation of our state of mind and our state of being, if you like, through indulgence, whether that's showering, whether that's bathing, whether that's simply just taking time to look after yourself.
One very interesting topic that we discussed in various events with COLA around the world is this notion of automation. You obviously spoke from an informed industrial design angle, but there were people talking about how this might affect the way that traffic moves in cities, the way that your office behaves when you arrive. I think there was a very kind of gladdening consensus that automation probably won't spell the end of human interaction, but it may stop you flooding your bathroom because you've forgotten that you were drawing a bath. Is that the COLA house view, that automation is there for some of your needs, but it won't solve all of them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, of course, people get slightly spooked when things happen without you actually bidding it. And without you asking it, and AI and, you know, the whole, whether that's artificial intelligence or augmented reality, it introduces that element of things happening without you asking for it. But it does create a backdrop for concentrating on things that really matter to you rather than having to deal with the mundane. And I think that's a heightening of experience, a heightening of pleasure. And, you know, and that's an important thing in life, to have fun and enjoy yourself, find that moment of peace and relaxation and escape from the hubbub that will be going on outside your door.
As a society, we're ever more concerned with novelty, with new technology, and also maybe kind of courting a younger consumer as well. But I'm a little interested in the effect of technology, or should I say the capacity of technology, to help the elderly. I mean, there's an example that I gave about how automation in shops is great for efficiency, but isn't great if Doris from around the corner doesn't get to speak to anyone during the day and no one looks after her keys. And that comes back to automation as well. But how are the elderly in a position to benefit from the technology that you're working with or the design that you're working on?
I think the door opened, you know, a few years ago when touch screens and interactive screens became the method of interacting with technology and with the benefits it can bring. Before that, if you hadn't risen in the gaming culture and knew how to use 25 different buttons in different ways, you were somewhat locked out. And I think that's opened the door, and aging populations can now access the incredible benefits of being connected. And, you know, one of the things we forget about is a great part of aging is, you know, it's all about independence and it's all about loneliness. You know, it's about feeling part of a community, even though you're less mobile or less, perhaps less connected than you were through your physical movement. So technology allows you to interact in new ways and allows you to be part of a community that isn't on your doorstep. And it also then brings, of course, all sorts of monitoring, safety, and company. You know, I saw a fascinating article that, you know, the Sony robot dogs that were defunct somewhat 10 years ago, there's a thriving undercurrent in the market which is maintaining those and updating them to be companions for elderly people. It's that simple interaction with something that seems to have life on a regular basis and that is comforting, you know, that makes a difference. Okay, that's an extreme example, but I think technology does allow you to have an open and engaging life for longer, provided you can interact with it seamlessly.
Thanks to Mark Biggerstaff there from COLA. We'll hear the second part of that interview a little later in the show, where we'll probe the privacy trade-off that comes with internet-enabled devices. But first, we ask how and if technology in the workplace can bring people together rather than isolate them, and whether the smartest workplaces are always the best ones to work in. Of all of the voices that joined our series of talks with COLA throughout the course of the year, that of Ron Backer, head of PLP architecture, caused perhaps the biggest stir, not least because the office building he designed uses the internet to refill out-of-beans coffee machines. Backer's building, The Edge, opened in Amsterdam in 2015, bedecked with some 30,000 sensors that help control everything from the light to the heating and workers' diaries. On the one hand, the building is efficient. Many dubbed it the smartest office in the world when it opened. But I was keen to learn how Backer balanced the building's bedazzling technology with a human scale and a desire to create spaces in which people were happy to linger and work. I sat down with Ron Backer for a précis of his presentation during London Design Week and started by asking him to explain how the concept for The Edge first came about.
I was trying to get people in a big organisation, people who didn't know each other very well, to have a chance to meet each other and talk about what they were doing. And that was not just me, but the main tenant of the building is Deloitte, large consultancy company doing much more of the stuff they're still going to be doing in 15 years' time. And robotics and machines have taken over accountancy and tax auditing. They are doing a lot more interesting stuff, and it's very important for them to talk to each other, to have an exposure to the larger issues that, you know, the businesses they support are into. That's a great challenge as an architect, because it's making spaces for people to meet is really kind of what we do, you know, in life. At least that's what I'm very interested in. And the building was almost created as a great big hub for people to meet. So it has a great atrium in the middle, and everybody can see the atrium, and everyone's sort of part of the spatial experience of it. In a way, that aspect is, for me, what still worked best about the building. So it's a great big sort of place to come home into, and people say that too. The smart part of the building was very much a sign of its time, perhaps a little bit ahead of the curve, but coming from a great ambition from the developers of the building and the main tenant and the consultant team to see how this experience of people working together could be improved by technology.
And so one interesting thing for me is that the way that we all work, the typology, if you will, of the workplace has changed vastly. And we're only just really coming out of that idea that we should all work in kind of cordoned off little spaces and, you know, everyone needs an office. Which parts of the traditional office you brought into this building and which bits you thought it could do without? Like, presumably there are no kind of hokey partitions and little bits where you can put up pictures of your family and stuff, or was that part of it?
Absolutely, yeah. And in a way, work these days is no longer the same for 8 hours a day. People have a diary of different tasks to do, and it's quite difficult actually to do all these things in the single one desk that normally people get allocated. So the idea of the project was to supply people with an opportunity to choose different types of workspaces for different types of activities. And they very happily do so. So people have the choice between normal desk space, standing desks for their back problems, or just because they feel like, you know, sitting is not so good for us anymore as we thought it was. And there are cubicles that are acoustically separated from the rest of the space. There are benches where you can sit with your work team. There are comfortable seats for taking telephone calls. And people have learned how to choose these for specific activities. And you'll find that some people do that very happily. They go around and want to sit next to other people every day. And other people just like to sit at the same desk every day with their cactus and a picture of their dog. And that's what they make their home. On the one hand, giving people exactly what they need is great. On the other hand, allowing people to express their wishes in a building is also kind of a new thing.
I always get the sense that there are two sides that are kind of battling against each other. One is the feeling of space that architects think about, you know, how people feel when they move through it, the proportion and the form. And the other thing is this label that the building seems to have been born with as the smartest office space. And smart, in my opinion, isn't an uncomplicated term. I think there's lots of things that are labelled smart that aren't that smart. But your building does a lot of things which weren't done before. It has 30,000 sensors fitted in it. It controls the ambient temperature for what goes on. Could you tell me a little bit about some of those innovations and maybe a little bit about how you had to balance them with what it felt like to be in that space?
The building is made as a kind of the best workspace you can have. So it looks at space, it looks at acoustical settings, a little bit left behind sometimes in architecture, but acoustics are very, very important for comfort. It looks at daylight. Daylight makes people very productive. And it's trying to balance all these types of different aspects of people's working comfort in the workplace. It actually means that there's an overlap of different technologies and different spatial aspects and different organizational aspects that happen at the same time. The building understands the lighting conditions and the temperature and quality of the air everywhere because it's measured by all those sensors. The building balances these decisions out against climate issues. So you don't want to sit by the window in the sunshine looking at the glare on your screen. So you're better sat at the other side of the office where you can leave the window open and let the daylight come in. At the same time, there's this balance with the energy use of the building, because if you sit in a daylit space, you don't need to switch the lights on and you don't need to put the cooling on, you know. So there are clever sort of overlaps of different technical systems that optimize the space. At the same time, it's a building for our age. So all the bits that move are connected through the IoT to the world or to their manufacturers, the coffee machines and the photocopiers and the lockers and the meeting rooms and the screens. You can talk to all of it with your phone. It feels a bit like there's this kind of organizing organism behind it all. And if you would ignore all the technology, you still have a great experience in the building. And for me, that's the smartest bit.
I agree. And we've talked before about data, and data is something that people are both afraid of giving up, but probably willing to, I would sense, make some compromises on if, for instance, it was cutting a building's energy consumption, say, and the amount of energy that in turn the city and the nation use, because it knows where you are in the building and whether you need these services. But I remember you telling me about one scheme, it may have been in the Edge, it may have been elsewhere, where people's data on their registration plates of their cars was being taken. And people saw that as an affront to the data because they thought, well, hang on, they know when I'm clocking in and out of work. I'm fine to have a sensor on my seat if the data's well managed and if no one's spying on me. But actually, that's a piece of personal information that I'm not willing to give up. Did you think about that, this balance between what data people are willing to trade off and not when you were designing the building and fitting all of this smart technology?
Yeah, it was almost a whirlwind of opportunity everybody saw for the future. So people who started working in the building also felt a bit like they were part of the experiment, you know, part of the pilot, which is very exciting. So when it became clear to people that certain types of data were being collected by the building to make it more productive and energy efficient and all of those things, the debate about personal data was just about happening in the Netherlands. But the number plate incident was quite soon because the barrier opens when it can see your car coming because it knows that you have a pass, you can park your car there. For most people, that is just great because then you don't have to stop and put your card into a machine and it goes more smoothly. Nobody has really an issue with that. And it's not the people in the building, but it was the unions who questioned this because it does give the system the opportunity to make notes of when people arrive and when people leave. But this happens at the same time that people are taken more seriously as intelligent human beings and they don't actually have to be there for certain times a day. They have a workload to get through or a deadline to achieve. But to counter the question, they asked everybody in the building what they thought of that. And it was a whopping 99% or something of people really didn't care at all. When people see the benefits of it for their own work or for their comfort or for the environment, then there are very few people who don't want to sign up.
Just as a final question, do you think the smartest office buildings that are being built now, which obviously are in the lineage of your building, do you think they're going to be the best places to work in the future? Are we at a point where that experimentation is translating into user-centered design and the individual is getting a much better experience alongside those benefits? Or are we still kind of feeling our way out a little bit?
No, I think that is the case. Better buildings are coming online now because of the technology. But it also happens to coincide with the time that we rediscovered the central part of the design of the built environment, which is human beings, you know? So we sort of forgot about that for a little while. But now the people are totally central in the considerations. So we do need to learn more about what makes spaces better, what is more comfortable for people, what are the choices they have. And there's still a lot to learn. But the learning is more about people, I think, than about technology.
That was founding partner of London-based PLP Architecture, Ron Backer, speaking to me recently at Midori House, right here in London. Another speaker whose work caught our attention, this time in Bangkok, was Sean Affleck. His studio Make Architects is in Hong Kong, a city that knows a thing or two about urban squeeze. Monocle's Paige Reynolds caught up with Sean, who began by explaining how design and the leaps and bounds we're making in technology are helping tackle living in ever smaller spaces.
Hong Kong is like any big major city. The infrastructure is expanding, but you just can't keep up with the demand of these growing cities, the growing mega cities. And so like a few years ago, last year, the standard was like a 400 square foot apartment, and now it's like 200 square foot apartment. And we understand the viability and the commercial realities of making it affordable, making sure that we can meet the market, making sure that the workers and the employees can be where they need to be to access where they need to go. But what we're trying to say is trying to use all this smart technology and all this sort of interconnectivity and communication to try and improve people's lives. So accept that maybe your livable space is much smaller, but then we can be generous, or trying to persuade developers to be generous with the amenity spaces, so they can have lounges and shared spaces and kitchens that you can go in and invite your friends, that you can book in advance, invite your friends, you cook a meal, not in your apartment, but within the shared space. And so all these amenities and facilities, we have to adapt, have to address the shortcomings of living in these much smaller spaces. And I suppose, optimistically, the way we're trying to approach it, we then believe that will give a sense of sharing, a sense of collaboration. So suddenly you will know your neighbours, you will know who lives down your corridor or the floor down below, and maybe we can start rebuild communities, which seem to have been lost over the years, as people become much more isolated living. And maybe this forcing people to live in smaller spaces means they've got to expand, they've got to step out, which means they can then start meeting people, collaborate, share. And maybe that's something that could be really good and really interesting.
And I know you're currently working on a, as yet, sort of unnamed residential project in Hong Kong. I wondered, are there any really specific smart design features that we might find surprising or that we haven't seen elsewhere that you could perhaps divulge a little bit?
The project we're trying to do in Hong Kong is acknowledging the fact that the apartments are getting smaller, and we're trying to improve the facilities to make up for the deficiencies. And if we get those right with all the connections and the connectivity in real time, we think we can make a great benefit to people's lives. In fact, maybe improve people's lives, as we said before, about collaboration, about sharing. And I think what's interesting, most of this technology is all around us, it's all there. It's trying to find ways of using it in a more interesting in a more positive way. For example, we're doing a hotel room which is right on the coast, and you look out the windows and Hong Kong's tremendous for the amount of ships and container ships, and that's the amount of traffic on the seas is absolutely fascinating. So we've designed this wall that will then just visually track the ships that you see out of your window, and that becomes this sort of beautiful art piece, sort of abstract art piece. But if you want to learn a little bit more, you can then tap on it and it will tell you where this ship has come from, where it's going. And I think having that knowledge makes life richer. And that's what we're trying to do, is that all that information is there, and if you want to access it, you can. It's easy. And then maybe with that comes more understanding.
That was Sean Affleck of Make Architects speaking to Monocle's Paige Reynolds in Bangkok after Monocle and Kohler's discussion entitled All Things Connected. And speaking of connections, let's get back to Mark Bickerstaff. Remember, he is the Director of New Product Development at Kohler Kitchen and Bath. Here he addresses the unease people feel when it comes to the handling of their personal data and suggests that a little give and take may be the inevitable price for connectivity in the home.
There is an inevitability, and I think it's something that we are all just learning to understand and find a way to manage. We don't trust many of the institutions in our society, you know, that collapsed some time ago. And I think that's the thing we're trying to find is, you know, who do we trust with our data? And the reality that some of the benefits that we really want to enjoy, you know, I think that's the thing, we want to enjoy them, they come with the price of releasing some personal data. I think that trade-off is something that we're wrestling with now, but I think over time we will see that actually the benefits are greater than the risks. I'm a bit worried about there's an element of exclusion that could happen. You know, if you don't release this data, you'll be excluded from a certain part of life and part of the benefits of that life.
I want to know a little bit about the other elements that you've brought into design. So everyone talks about form and function, but you're very interested in light, in the haptics, or, you know, the lack of haptics if things are used intuitively. Do you ever need to actually touch them? Could you tell me about some of the ways that you've brought your designs for Kohler or intend to bring them to life, you know, thinking not just about the form of the product?
Sure. I mean, we some time ago, a little while ago, started talking about meaning and perceived meaning rather than style. You know, style's a trap. The fact you can describe a style means that it's not an original expression. And I think that's something that that we started to deal with a few years ago. Meaning gets you further. And then meaning in the context of technology is really fascinating because it's changing all the time. That really is something that we've had to embark on significant research, going out and looking at how different cultures interact with technology, how they deal with signals and the triggers of graphics and formal shape of objects. And we're learning all the time. And, you know, there's an element that simplicity is better. And that is very true. But the way that we interact with that is changing all the time now. You know, how many times do we walk into a washroom and then we can't decide whether actually the tap we're looking at is touchless or not? So we wave our hands madly, hoping it'll work. And if it doesn't, you know, we look for things. So we're still in that mode of having to learn how to put these new triggers of behavior into our products. A fascinating time, a challenging time as a designer.
I'd like you to cast your mind back, Mark. Was there a person you heard from or a line of thinking that you were subjected to that you thought, wow, that's interesting, I'm going to take that with me from the COLA events, the most recent one obviously in Bangkok, but we spoke in London before, and I believe you attended certain others as well. What did you take from some of them?
True to form, one of the things that we were asked is, what would you like technology to deliver that was a benefit to you personally? And one of them is remembering people's names when I look at them, so rather than cite someone's name. You know, I think there were a couple of things that really came through. One was how similar the thinking was around technology and smart and integration and putting intelligence in places where it's not overt. That was common across a lot of the regions. You know, we spanned the globe with this and the discussion. And it was great to see that thinking was shared, the fear about release of data. But I think what also emerged was very much this clear alignment that, you know, we're in a two-speed world. We're in a multi-speed world, but we're really in a two-speed world where, and I think you framed it actually, Josh, very well, which was, you know, we're quite happy to wait for our drip coffee.
Oh, but we'll moan when the internet's slow.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a difference of, you know, a few seconds before you moan about the internet, but you'll wait 5 minutes for the right coffee. I think, you know, we're just a generation that's getting used to this new multi-speed world. And, you know, you can make all sorts of far-reaching connections. But, you know, am I surprised that mental health issues are on the rise in this world where we are bombarded with feeds from all sorts of directions and we're trying to find our center and our connection to the world? Absolutely not. You know, that's one of the challenges of this modern age is finding that new balance mentally, you know, forget the physical side, just mentally, in extracting benefit, being able to put it to one side to actually have physical interaction with our neighbours and our family and our friends and our colleagues and make that meaningful, as meaningful as the technological interactions we have every day.
Our sincere thanks to Mark Bickerstaff, the Director of New Product Development at COLA Kitchen and Bath. And it's with regret that that's all the time we have for today. Next week.
Mexico City is so rich in information and it's so dynamic that the city becomes the material library.
From Mexican architect Frida Escobedo to California modernism and more, we bring you a special show stuffed with some of our favourite interviews and reports from Monocle on Design throughout 2018. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and, what fun, our sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra 2, which is available each Thursday. You can also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, that's the forecast or the February edition, which will be out in early January, or, of course, one of our winter weekly newspaper series. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett, but to play us out, here is the Stereo MCs with Connected.